Hi, my name is Julia. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everyone. So, would you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic as well.
So this is wild to be here. We haven't been here in a long time. So we felt rather honored actually when we got asked to speak here. This is an impressive group in many respects. It's a singular one. So we commenced to trying to figure out what all we wanted to say. So I hope you'll find something. There, I feel like there's always something new to gather, to unpack. But hopefully we'll bring something to y'all. So I actually wanted to start with the doctor's opinion tonight, which is usually the first thing when I've sponsored folks, the first thing I ask them to read. So I think if you're in the, I think everybody's got a fourth edition, right?
Yeah.
So we'll just dive in to the doctor's opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So it begins. So most of you probably know the history, right, of who Dr. Silkworth is. He treated Bill in Towns Hospital, and he treated a lot of hopeless alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And he's one of the people who's like an early hero of AA, a friend of AA, not an alcoholic. And he had a particular perspective on alcoholics. And one thing that I've been thinking about is the degree to which non-alcoholics have contributed to this program of ours. And I'll get to the specifics of like what I found from them. But I think it's important for me to remember that that a lot of people have made this program possible. And we have a lot to be grateful for. There are people who didn't really gain anything, you know, by contributing to this program. And I think we owe a debt of gratitude to these folks. They didn't, you know, they weren't drunks. You know, they just saw the suffering, and they had just an inordinate amount of compassion, and I would argue humility, like of a kind that I don't really know and that I aspire to. So I just, you know, I think we love another drunk. We love other drunks. We love the drunkalogs. We love the stories of redemption. But a lot of what we enjoy today and what we've got is thanks to these early friends of AA. So with that, I'm just going to go ahead and read. We of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who have had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician, at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may mark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves. So we know the alcoholic he's talking about, right? He's talking about Bill. And so this last sentence blows me away. If you think about a doctor these days saying anything along the lines of you may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves, I mean, the degree to which, you know, any doctor I see will sort of equivocate and say, well, you know, it's probably this, you know, probably some vitamin D will help you. you know, and yes, I've read that too on WebMD, you know, like, and they'll give you percentages, they'll give you likelihoods, but rarely do they say anything like, rely absolutely. So this notion of him being thoroughly convinced is right here. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement, which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. So this is where it starts to get personal when I read this. He's not saying here that that we couldn't control our drinking and this was a real problem. What he says is we're maladjusted to life, and we're in full flight from reality. So Jim and I had decided that the theme of this first talk that we did was going to be the diagnosis. You know, what is alcoholism really? And this notion, like, he's not talking about when we're drinking that we're in full flight. He's talking about, like, all the time. When we wake up in the morning, we're in full flight from reality. And which is a pretty huge statement. And something that I think, you know, you guys know this. I'm not telling anything you don't already know, but it's, you know, it's not about the drinking. It's not about the drinking. And it's also not about the drinking. You know, like in that, but that's a start. You gotta start somewhere. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is complete. Fair enough. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor a hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or befogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. So he's acknowledging, you know, the physical allergy, which is like our initial diagnosis, which is the sort of the threshold of entry, right? It's like the physical allergy. Did you get it?
Nailed
it. That'll be on the recording for posterity. The doctor writes, "The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. I say this after many years' experience as a medical doctor of one of the oldest hospitals in the country, treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on a subject which is covered in such masterly details in these pages." So again, right here we have the humility, that modeling of humility for the other folks when they see us. "We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge." So again, I mean, I'm reminded of that humility, right? And of his acceptance that, having witnessed everything that wasn't working, that these straightforward solutions really, really didn't apply, and that we needed, right, a much larger solution. I think what I'm struck by is this notion that no matter what modernity brings, it's never going to be large enough to deal with our problem. I'm going to skip around a little bit. Many years ago, later he requested the privilege of being allowed to tell his story to other patients here, and with some misgiving, we consented. "The cases we have followed through have been most interesting. In fact, many of them are amazing. The unselfishness of these men, as we have come to know them, the entire absence of profit motive, and their community spirit, is indeed inspiring to one who has labored long and wearily in this alcoholic field. They believe in themselves, and still more in the power, capital P, which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. It was funny, when I read this, I thought about, although it's, you know, I know this is a step workshop, but how this reminded me a little of the traditions and how it presages like the this idea that if we're going to help people, we have to do it from a place of pure heart and pure desire to carry the message. And I know that's not the focus of this, but it was just a good reminder to me. Mm-hmm. Of course, an alcoholic ought to be freed from his physical craving for liquor, and this often requires a definite hospital procedure before psychological measures can be of maximum benefit. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of analogy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. So I was just going to jump in with a little of my experience just while I'm here, the physical allergy. So I don't want to go into any great detail, but let's just say that by the end of my drinking, I was pretty much drinking 24/7. If I was asleep, I wasn't drinking, but that's kind of it. And it was impossible. I was one of those people. Like, so I know there are a lot of people who are quote binge drinkers and what have you. That wasn't me. My addiction, in the many ways that it can show up, we'll get to that later, is one of constancy, consistency, order, regularity. I don't binge with stuff. I'm sort of an all or nothing gal, and I'm going to do it all the time. So, toward the end of my drinking, it took me 36 hours to get through a fifth of vodka. And I was using dry goods along the way to make that possible. So I can certainly identify with the physical allergy. And I can tell you that I was completely unable to stop drinking for any period of time. And so I know well the physical allergy. But I can also tell you that I still know that that was just the beginning. That the drinking was not the problem. It was, as we say, my solution. And it worked brilliantly until it stopped working. Mm-hmm. But here we go. This is the part that I identified most when I read this. Their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. So again, just during my active alcoholism, those things included paying my electric bill on time. You know, this is before online payment, and I still can pay things late, but I mean, I had the money, but I was still getting, my electricity got turned off at one point. I think maybe a couple of other things got turned off, and not just because I couldn't deal, and everything seemed utterly impossible. And I'm talking about those kinds of things. I was, although I had a job, I would argue I was unemployable. I think I was in danger of being fired at any moment. But that's the kind of unmanageability that I can, in my drinking, that I can really relate to. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. So I'm thinking here in my own experience of my mother, my family, my friends. And in a way, like, it's not kind to call those appeals frothy, right? Like, I think Silkworth knew his audience and knew that that as alcoholics we might feel that these appeals were frothy. They're kind of lightweight, you know, they didn't because they weren't working. But they were also pretty heartbreaking. You know, they were heartbreaking certainly from the person making the appeal. And they were heartbreaking for me to know that I couldn't I couldn't give up the drinking, you know, and I had no interest in doing so. That was just not going to ever work for me, no matter what. And it wasn't that I didn't want to. It wasn't that I couldn't, that I didn't have consequences. Oh my God, so many consequences. But I couldn't imagine life without drinking. I just couldn't, it's, and I'm going to use this word, imagine. I couldn't imagine it. And I'll get to that later. But that's for me, was the greatest barrier of all, is imagining a life without drinking, and that a life could be worth living without drinking. Hmm. If any feel that as psychiatrists, directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental. Let them stand with us a while in the firing line. And here we see like all the brutal stuff that these guys have gone through, and all those professionals who try to help us, and talk about heartbreaking. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That is putting it mildly. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. So, normalize things for me. Plastic, those plastic booze bottles that I kept under my seat in my car, all that. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, the famous ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks which they see others taking with impunity. By the time I got to the end of this paragraph, so I came into the rooms while I was still drinking. I thought, I don't know what I thought. I guess I thought if I just sat here, I would lose the desire to drink or something, but I tried it. I did go to one rehab knowing I would come out and drink. But I have to tell you, when I read this, I'm an alcoholic. I believe that I'm special. Well, I was one of the special ones who, you don't understand, none of you guys understand. You don't know what happened. Like, my life was so heartbreaking. My husband left me. He shouldn't. You know, on and on and on. And all the reasons I drank. And by the time I got to this part of the paragraph and saw that this doctor, who's already presented himself as a pretty trustworthy and humble, you know, an experienced guy, that he sees me just as one of a group of people. Mm. I am not special. And every ounce of me, I was infuriated by this paragraph and by a lot of the doctor's opinion, because it rang so goddamn true. And it meant that I was one of a group. I was no longer this unique person. And so that's why I love, one of the reasons I love the doctor's opinion, is that it started to chip away at my ego. It started to chip away at my very poor belief that I was special. On the other hand, as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, "Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop, but I cannot. You must help me." And that's where that sort of crying out, that kind of ambivalent crying out, like knowing you've got consequences, or knowing I had consequences, "I must stop, but I cannot." There was a part of me, I knew that at bottom I wanted to, that I had to keep drinking, no matter what I told the doctor. Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Again, the humility. Although he gives all that is in him, it often is not enough. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit we have made little impression on the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. And then he goes on to list examples of this. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving, which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. The classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths. So he starts to list these different folks. But the sentence that jumps out to me here, they are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. And I wondered, I wasn't sure of the timing and whether, if he had had a good look at the 12 steps at this point, because there's sort of an overlap in this period. But this idea of making a decision rather than resolution is a critical one. I think we can resolve to do all kinds of things, but the decision has a sort of moment to it, has a decisiveness to it that I was never willing to make. And so the next paragraph is kind of funny because he starts to list different kinds of alcoholics. And I know that in many respects he's true, but for me reading this, I was every one of those people. I was every one of those kinds of alcoholics at a different stage. You know, I was the manic depressive. I was the one who tried to change my brand and my environment. I was all of these guys. So, as I'm reading more and more through this for the first time, I'm really starting to get in what ways I'm an alcoholic. And it becomes hard for me to run because I've got this experienced doctor and his observations, you know, and I also fancy myself, you know, at the time like I was a scientific type of person, you know. And the evidence is just, it's all there, you know, and there's nothing I can argue. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. Again. Let's see. Okay, so then he goes in and he talks about examples. So this is, again, thinking of this guy as a man of science. So we know how scientists usually work. They conduct lots of experiments. They build data. They use a scientific method. And at this point, the doctor has tried everything, but he starts to turn into a storyteller, which I just love. So we know that in Alcoholics Anonymous, that the way we carry the message most effectively is to share our own stories. And all of a sudden, the doctor turns into a storyteller. And I just find that really cool. So he goes into the story about 1 year prior to this experience, a man was brought in to be treated for chronic alcoholism. He had but partially recovered from a gastric hemorrhage and seemed to be a case of pathological mental deterioration. He had lost everything worthwhile in life and was only living, one might say, to drink. He frankly admitted and believed that for him there was no hope. Following the elimination of alcohol, there was found to be no permanent brain injury. So I'm just going to back this up a little bit. So here's a guy who's, you know, he said he's lost everything. So by the end of my drinking, as I said, I was unemployable. I had alienated everybody in my life. And just so you know, like, I grew up in Westfield. I went to a good college. I had every goddamn privilege, you know, that really you can name. And here I was, like, losing everything. And it kind of didn't matter because I lacked that imagination. I couldn't, it's that whole thing of like, I didn't know what I didn't know. All I knew was I couldn't handle the discomfort of not drinking. There was really no point for me. And so I was giving up everything. And that wasn't going to stop me. Consequences didn't. For all the people I've known and all the heartbreaking cases, consequences, like, don't stop me from drinking. They just don't. So here we have this guy. Right? However, he accepted the plan outlined in this book. 1 year later, he called to see me, and I experienced a very strange sensation. I knew the man by name and partly recognized his features, but there all resemblance ended. From a trembling, despairing, nervous wreck had emerged a man brimming over with self-reliance and contentment. I talked with him for some time, but was not able to bring myself to feel that I had known it before. To me, he was a stranger, and so he left me. A long time has passed with no return to alcohol. So what the doctors observed, obviously, is, you know, somebody who's you know, recovered or who has surrendered, who's done the work, who's in a different place altogether. And again, what he's not saying is the guy's not drinking. That's almost like the last, that is the very last thing he says about this person. What he's struck by is that this is a different human altogether. Mm-hmm. And that is interesting. That is interesting. So when I remember when I got to that part, I thought, well, you know, maybe there is something here. Maybe there is something here. So at this point, I'm seeing the diagnosis is like, it's pretty clear. It's pretty clear I have the allergy. But I still, what the doctor can't know is what it feels like to be an alcoholic. But what he offers here is a beautiful picture of what an alcoholic looks like. And I find that very moving. I find that very moving because he's seen a lot of alcoholics. And they all share these things in common. And so when I read that, I realized that there maybe was, it did allow me to think maybe there was a little hope for me. Maybe this thing, Alcoholics Anonymous, is a real thing. Because I know, like for me, I knew that I couldn't live without drinking, being in the state I was, with my mind working the way it did, with the same priorities in place. It just wasn't going to work. It just was not going to work. If I had those same beliefs, I'd have to drink. That's what I knew. Mm-hmm. When I need a mental uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York. The patient had made his own diagnosis and decided in his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. Right? We're pretty sure willpower doesn't work, right? Hmm. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology, and we doubted if even that would have any effect. However, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book, and he has not had a drink for a great many years. I see him now and then, and he is as fine a specimen of manhood as one could wish to meet. I earnestly advise every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. So, by the end of this, I began to see that maybe there was something out there, you know, maybe there was a shift that could happen. Maybe there was, if I became a different person, then maybe I wouldn't have to drink. You know, that's kind of what I believed at bottom. And I also know from this that this is, the doctor himself has told me the limits of human experience and science when it comes to alcoholism. There's got to be a solution that's larger than the problem. And what I walked away with when I was finished was the sort of feeling of like an undeniable truth. And I've it's been my experience, and I've heard from others that as much as we don't want to know the truth necessarily, alcoholics at bottom kind of know the truth when they're presented with it. And it could be that may be part of our condition. It could be that part of that is like we're so aware of pain and suffering or some darkness. I'm not sure. It's not a completely formulated thought, but there's something about truth, an undeniable truth, and that little bit of self-knowledge that it takes, that when I finished reading the doctor's opinion, I didn't know if I could stop drinking, but I knew the gig was up. Like, I knew the game was over. And there was really no place to go from there. So that's really all I...
Thank you, Jim.
Take it over.
So, I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. So Julie and I were talking about the fact that, I mean, essentially, Dr. Silkworth is pointing out the fact that, I mean, pretty much modern medicine didn't really have a solution for us. I mean, that was kind of pretty clear. That he was basically handing it over to Alcoholics Anonymous, saying, like Julia mentioned, that, you know, you can take anything these guys say to the bank. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And so I thought it would be helpful for me to just share kind of some of my experience with being kind of disconnected. In 2003, I've been sober. This October will be 18 years. And that's 18 years off of pills. But I haven't had a drink since, I think it was 1990. So there was many years, like 15, something like that, in that range of not drinking, but not being sober in a true sense. So I don't know if Dr. Silkworth had me figured out, but, you know, because there was a fair period of time there where I thought I was sober, you know, because I wasn't drinking. And I wasn't taking any other illegal drugs, just the prescribed ones. Even though they were, you know, they're narcotics, you know, class one or whatever, you know, narcotics that you can't take in rehab, that's for sure. Anyway, each weekend at rehab, the priest there would have a mass. It was kind of a multi, you know, there was people reading the Quran. He was a Catholic priest, so it was a very inclusive kind of thing. And I think it was either the first or second week, he talked about how being in addiction, you're disconnected from God, yourself, the universe, and others. And that's pretty much everything. You know, so you're completely disconnected from anything that means anything. And certainly I was not aware of that when I showed up there. Most people that showed up there, you know, came in with walkers and were pretty beat up. You know, since I hadn't drank in a long time and I was on pills, I showed up there looking pretty good. You know what I mean? However, in a couple weeks, I looked worse than anybody there because now I was in my withdrawal from the pills, and that's pretty brutal after being on them for like 20 years. So my experience of, but what this allowed me to start to see was identifying with how disconnected I was. At the time I entered rehab, I had a 9 and an 11 year old. I had been, let's see, 2003, I'd been divorced for about 7 years. So that was a clear disaster. My whole family thing was like just a catastrophe. And I didn't really... So when you're many, many years of drinking and drugging and then another block of time of just being heavily medicated, regardless of whether I was abusing them or not, the fact that I didn't know what was happening is... You know, I look back on it now, it's embarrassing. Do you know what I mean? I had no clue. Like, I was going to meetings. I was kind of half-assed trying to, you know, I mean, I wasn't drinking. What do you want from me? You know what I mean? So I didn't show up there knowing anywhere close to what kind of trouble I was in. I had really zero clue. It was only an unfolding over time that led me to understand, like, wow, this is bigger than I thought it was. Because when I look back on it, there was probably 30 years of making no normal maturing, no growth, no kind of, you know, here's an issue, here's a problem, or how are we going to figure this out? No, it was just a big kind of steamrolling through life without really feeling much or being aware of much. It's hard for me to get my head around that actually is true for me. I don't consider myself an idiot. You know what I mean? But that is in fact what that's my experience. I mean, that's what happened. Julie and I were talking about how we can be disconnected obviously in active addiction. It's easy to see how we're disconnected. But in sobriety then, like, am I connected now? I guess so. I mean, I'm not drinking. And so my experience is that because you're no longer drinking or drugging, I think Dr. Silkworth points out pretty clearly that our real problem is not that we're... I mean, our substances are not the problem. That's what we kind of found to kind of mitigate the pain, interior pain and unmanageability. At least that's kind of how I understand it. And so, you know, knowing that, I mean, the experience of me coming off the pills, so I had my physical withdrawal to deal with, which was beyond brutal. And so, you know, the state of my nervous system, to say that was challenging was just like the understatement of the century. So, you know, it's like fighting Mike Tyson with, you know, two hands tied behind my back. It just was an unfair fight. And so, again, to touch on the fact that, you know, was I connected and back on the beam now that I'm no longer on the pills? I haven't drank in a long time. I was nowhere close to being connected in any true sense. And I think I need to understand, and I didn't at the time, that you just need some time to just, you know, figure out what planet you're on. And I know everybody comes into recovery at a different place. You know, some people have had horrible consequences. Some people, it's not been so bad. And in my case, I didn't think it was so bad, and it was really horrible. You know what I mean? So to get kind of upright, it took quite a while. One of the things I think was most kind of, if I really look back on my time after getting off the pill, so now I'm quote unquote completely clean. You know, no pills. I'm on my own power. This is all me now. And with my situation with my ex and my children was completely a disaster. You know what I mean? I had no ability to deal with that in a sober fashion. I wasn't compromised. You know, I mean, I was sober. I was physically sober. But I wasn't in any way able to act in a sober way. It was not possible. And so I was doing the best that I could. And I think just in terms of my identification with what Dr. Silkworth is pointing out, my experience of that with inactive addiction and then in early recovery, and I'm talking years in, not a couple months till it got better. I'm talking years in. So I don't want to go too far beyond that, because we're just really in the diagnosing stage and identifying with being lost and trying to get found. and I wanted to give Julia an opportunity to share her experience with being lost and trying to be found.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting to me is this, as I said, that we are talking about this experience, you know, today as we were preparing for this, and how I couldn't imagine life without drinking, and And I made the comparison of like you're like in a dark room, and you know, like you cut off, like I was cut off from everybody and everything, and I was literally like very isolated. I hadn't put the garbage bags on the windows yet or anything like that, but like this feeling of being in a dark room, and then finally you find the light bulb and you turn the light bulb on, and that's maybe when. Comparing that to like putting the drink down, the one that's in front of you, putting the drink down, you turn the light, and then you see what a shit show the room is. Like then you see it's a complete disaster, and so that light bulb is not the power, but it lets you see a little dose of reality. And the first time I tried to get sober, that was enough to make me start drinking again. Just like turn off that light. But at least putting the drink down lets me see that bit of reality. And then the recovery process is about like opening the windows and letting the sunlight in, you know, and allowing different colors of light, you know, to come in and give you a new perspective. But initially, that light bulb experience is very unpleasant. And it did, you know, my story is one of multiple relapses because I couldn't handle the discomfort. I didn't have a program, didn't have a connection with a higher power. And I think too, like we were sharing, like, you know, we can, again, we'll get to this later, we can go back to that place, you know, like without drinking. Like, it's not just about that, and it's not fun. Because it's, you know, taking that power back, right? And you wanted to.
Well, did you want to share more about your experience of being in sobriety and being disconnected?
Yeah, I mean, just so again, like we'll get more to this more later, but I just from my own experience that I can at any moment. Feel like I'm in addiction. There's this guy who talks about the vibration of addiction, but there's a feeling. There's a feeling that I get in my body of when I like I'm not in the decision place, and when I'm not in recovery, and when I am controlling stuff, and like it can happen really quickly. I see something I want. My motives aren't clear. And I will force an issue. I will. My job is one in which like I'm supposed to. It's, you know, I edit, and I miss things, and I make mistakes. And that is the most intolerable thing for me to handle. Like that is my big challenge, is this perfectionism, which is completely out of alignment. With being in recovery, you know, I'd say that's one of my most common places where I really feel that discomfort and feel the urge to numb, and that can happen in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
We also wanted to give folks some time to share, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, we should maybe say what our next themes are going to be, what we're looking at. For the weeks ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we were going to next week look into the surrender process. You know, when you kind of just lay the weapons down. Say, I can't do this anymore. That's again, different for everyone. What kind of pain and suffering they can withstand before that happens. And that's why...
it's basically step one cover.
Yeah.
Yeah,
basically we'll deal with step one and probably maybe
I'm a little edging into two and three.
A little bit into two and three. But yeah, the surrender process for me took quite a while. You know what I mean? When you look at I thought I surrendered when I stopped drinking. I mean, that's what I thought. But in actuality, I had another 15 years of complete just cluelessness. You know what I mean? And I just didn't know that that was what was going on. I just when I came to in the Karen Foundation and realized like what kind of, you know, like what kind of shape my physical body was in and my nervous system, I was just like, wow. I don't think, had I known what I was going to get into, I'd have never gone there. I just wouldn't have gone. Do you know what I mean? There's no way. Because nobody would do that. That's like a just a core survival skill that you wouldn't put yourself through. You know what I mean? So that was one of the first acts of divinity that I really experienced. That like, how do you get here? Do you know what I mean? Given like the magnitude of what you're going to have to kind of try to walk through. And so when I look back now, didn't see that at the time, but looking back on it now, that's how, at least in my experience, how God works in your life when you're not even aware of it. You have an intention, at least. You know, you're giving it your best shot, no matter how lost you are. And I think when you do that, it's like that saying of, you know, if you have the nerve to jump off the cliff, that God will catch you. It's just really hard to jump off, you know, when you don't know that anything's going to actually catch you.
And then the third week, we were going to...
Third week, we're coming home.
Coming home. Program action.
Yeah.
And then fourth week?
Fourth week is gardening.
If you make it this one?
Gardening.
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 Yeah, weeding the garden, maintaining your sobriety. You know, when you fall back into the pit, there was a guy. Can I tell him about the bungee cord guy?
Oh,
when you get yanked into the, when I was at rehab, this was actually not in rehab. This was down in Kentucky. I went for some outside help, as they say, and he drew a line down a chalkboard. And he listed all the things that we do in recovery. We go to meetings, we get a sponsor, we sponsor people, we do service, and all the things that we do. And on the other side was all the things that are kind of typical of active addiction. Gossiping about others, complaining about stuff, getting freaked out and, you know, just, you know, acting crazy. And he said, you can think you're in recovery, actually, when you're doing all these great things, you are in recovery. When you start to slip, there's a bungee cord that's anchored over in the addiction side, and if you're not doing all these things, that cord yanks you. Yeah, you get yanked right over into the active addiction side. Even though you're not drinking or drugging, you're no longer kind of in recovery. You know what I mean? Just because you're not drinking and drugging, I don't consider myself to be in recovery if I'm behaving in a way that's not sober. You know what I mean? You have to kind of be doing the whole deal, at least in my estimation.
Great.
Yeah, so the gardening is key. You know, if you're lucky enough to get to that far.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So I think that...
So I think it takes us to close to... 7:30, okay. So we open it up for...
Yeah.